Hello and welcome to Talking Scared. I'm your host, Neil McRobert, and this week we're talking about the Goldilocks zone of stories, the novella. Not too long, not too short, just the perfect length to horrify you, if done right. Thankfully, I'm joined by a pair of practitioners who know exactly what they're doing. Josh Malerman and Ronald Malfi have both released novella collections this year. Josh's Spinner Black Yarn is a set of five stories that take you from a uniquely haunted house to the centre of Saturn via a terrible deathbed confession. Ron's They Lurk has a similar spread, featuring body horror in a motel parking lot, a possession, maybe, in Germany, and a slice of what I'm calling cryptid noir. Both are fantastic collections, and both authors are great fun to talk to about horror and writing. And this episode is actually packed with useful advice about the novella, about writing and rhythm, and about as much enthusiasm for story that you can pack into a single hour and a bit of conversation. Let's just say that Josh and Ron bond over these stories. And that's without you even hearing the 10 minutes of guitar nerd chat before we got going. Sadly, I didn't record that bit, but if you do want to hear more Talking Scared, you can sign up as a Patreon and help support this show whilst getting tons of bonus content. I'm about to do a big AMA to celebrate turning 40, so yeah, that's one not to miss. Just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod and sign up. It's only money. It's not your soul, I promise. But now, come with me to a dimly lit bar somewhere in Michigan or Maryland. There's a band on the stage playing a relentless song that you may never, ever get out of your head. Let's talk scared. Ronald, Josh, hello and welcome back to Talking Scared. How are you both?
Hello. Wonderful.
I'm great. How are you? And hello, Josh, too.
Hi.
Oh, that's always useful. I do this thing where I say, like, how are you? And then don't introduce the names. I just assume that other people know who's talking. So, Ron, say hello.
Hello.
Josh, say hello.
I'm Josh Malerman. Hello, ladies and gentlemen.
We're good. And how are you both?
Well, it's kind of, you know how like people are like, you know, like how it's a weird thing to read the book and then the next day see the movie or that night see the movie. Yeah. I'm going through a similar, but a much cooler thing right now where I just finished Ronald's book yesterday and now I'm seeing him and I just had a real moment with you, man. Like I had a real moment of sinking into this book for a week. And so to see you immediately, like this doesn't always happen. This is cool.
No, it is cool. It's even cooler because I went through the same experience. I mean, I think I was sitting finishing up Josh's book last night at a bar, and which is a great place to read Josh's work because you need to be surrounded by people who are not going to look at you too closely, but you know that they're there, and that's very Josh. yeah, and then we sent some messages back and forth, and you know, after two whiskeys, I think I sounded pretty cogent in the messages, but I'm much. I guess I'll be more on my ball now today. But yeah, it's a little surreal. It's very cool.
You guys are pulling the weight then, because I read both of your books quite a few months ago now, because we were supposed to do this a while back, and then it got pushed for various reasons. So I am notoriously bad at remembering character names, and I've read like 12 books since I read yours, so I could be all over the place. I'm kind of relying on you two to know what the hell you both wrote about.
No, Neil, I have that same problem with my own. Like, I'll be at a convention or something, and someone will be like, man, so why did Don do this? And I'm like, who the hell is Don? and they're like, oh, it's the guy in Bird Box. Oh, yeah. Oh, geez. Wow. No, I knew that. I thought you were talking about, you know, someone else.
Now, I am the exact same way. So we'll all be very forgiving.
I quite literally can't remember a thing. I read Kat Ward's book, Looking Glass Sound, about 4 or 5 books ago. And it's a really complex beast, that book, right? It's a really kind of metafictional tangle. And I adored it. And I still know that I love it, but I can't really remember what happens anymore. My mind is just like a sieve these days.
This is something I think about often, that for me, it's often, it's not, what's the right phrase? It's like the feeling of mm-hmm. having read it, the experience of having read it is more important to me than maybe like the details of having mm-hmm. read it. So if you read her book and you just like, you felt electrified by it, there's more momentum to be found there in your life, in your thinking, than there is to be found in you read it and now months later, you're like an expert on it. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. for me, it's more that spiritual, like that ride or that lift from having read a book that you love. So I'm similar. I don't remember a lot of shit from the books, but I absolutely remember the experience itself.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly it. Yeah, exactly it. Well, let's talk about your books because we haven't named them yet. So you both wrote novella collections. Ron, yours is called They Lurk, and Josh, yours is Spin a Black Yarn. Each contains 5 stories. And there are other points of similarity, but that's a nice balance. They each contain 5 stories. So I thought, because you're both personable chaps, I thought, why not get you together on the show to talk about the stories in whatever degree we want to, and more broadly about the art of the novella. Let's be pretentious. The art of the novella, because the way I see it, it's very much its own beast as a form of storytelling. I mean, do we agree on that much?
Oh, sure.
Oh yeah, 100%. Yeah. The shorter the horror story, the more like powerful it is. I feel like the scariest stories I've ever heard are like the 3-sentence stories that a friend tells me his ghost story. Like, oh, you write scary stories? One time I was in the basement and my dead aunt peered around the furnace. And I'll be like, what? Wait, what? And that's it. That's all I needed. And I'm like, dude, that's the scariest story I've ever heard. You know, like, okay. So now, can you maintain that for the duration of a short story? Yes. Can you maintain that for the duration of a novel? Well, yes. And those are some books we absolutely love. Like Pen Pal does that. And yeah. I think Ian Reed does that. And like, that's kind of like, if you pull that off, you feel like, yes, I maintain that for the whole novel. But the novella, it gives you enough room to do a lot of the things the novel does, but it's also, I don't want to say easier, but it's more likely to maintain that mood throughout mm-hmm. the whole thing. And so to me, that's the most beguiling part of the novella is that it's like, oh, right. I can keep this one note, this one song. It's like a long song, like a Pink Floyd song mm-hmm. versus, you know, the Velvet Underground, like short story.
I mean, yeah, that's I agree 100%. You got to be on your game to scare somebody, I think, and to do a short story well. I don't think of myself as a particularly strong short story writer. My stuff is either too ambiguous or it's too packed. That balance, because there's no room for imperfection if you're writing what you try to do is a good short story. Conversely, a novel, you can be a little clunky depending on how big the book was. You get your point across, but there's room for forgiveness. You could have the boom mic slip into a frame every once in a while. It's okay. But a novella, man, I think it's perfectly suited, particularly for this genre. And for a lot of what Josh said is that it you can maintain the elements that make a short piece of horror, whether it's spoken to you like the ant behind the furnace, or you can maintain that throughout a novella, but you also can flavor that with the elements that make a novel so rich. And I think it cuts a great balance.
So we've talked about what we like about them, but when you set out to write, have you ever intentionally decided to write a novella, or do they happen by accident?
That's a great question, man.
Yeah.
For me, Spin a Black Yarn, I set out to write a collection of novellas. So it originally opened with Daphne. Daphne was the first novella. And I sent this in to Del Rey, and Trisha wrote me back. This first, Daphne was the first one, because I thought it was a good idea to start with like a fastball just over the plate. Like, here's a straight up horror story, and then we'll get far out from here. And she was like, no, this is your next book, this first one. Let's expand this. I was like, wow, Daphne? Okay, you know? Like, so there was no intention there. But I wrote Daphne, Half the House is Haunted, Argyle, Doug and Judy, all like in a row. And so there was that intention to set out to do it. But the thing that can kind of turn on you there is like, and when I was reading Ronald's, I'm like, each one of these could be a novel. I mean, how could Fierce could of course be a novel? Fierce, for listeners, is the last story in They Lurk, Ronald's book. And of course, I mean, all of them though could be. So at some point there's like this dual thinking, right? Where one is like, am I selling this short? Like, could this actually be its own whole thing? And the other side of you is, are you kidding me? I got a book where I get to get five ideas out at once.
Yeah.
That is like awesome. That's like the greatest feeling. So mine was intentional. How about you, Ronald?
Yeah. I mean, thinking on it, pretty much all the novellas I'd written that I had published were set out to be novellas, either because they were under contract for a certain piece or, you know, the last two books I did for Titan were novella collections, They Lurk, and prior to that was Ghostwritten. Ghostwritten's a bit of a different animal, and like Josh was saying, it's a longer book than They Lurk, and the novellas themselves are longer. They're some of them almost push 200 pages. There was a moment when writing all four of those and Ghostwritten where I was like, am I selling myself short? Is this a full not? Could this be a full novel? And two things kind of got me out of that. One is when I looked at it, I said, this thing is moving like a locomotive. Do I really want to add another 150, 200 pages to this story? Is that really where I want to take it? Or do I love the smell of it and the feel of it right now? So that kind of pulled me out of it. And the other thing I did, which I enjoyed with Ghostwritten, which Josh did with Goblin, is this is four novellas about, each one's about a separate haunted book or manuscript or writer. And that's like the thread that connected them all. But as I was writing them separately, I realized these are all stories that could link together. And actions of one character in novella one may affect the outcome in novella four. Man. And it ties in. And if you're really, really reading it closely, because there's like a character who's specifically mentioned in each of the four novellas and a part of that character's story, that it creates a fifth story once you read all of them together. So I almost like to think of it as a novel. So that one came a little bit different. But with They Lurk was, those were all written as novellas. Four of those were published with originally with Dark Fuse. And when they went out of business, those books went out of print. So I just kind of brought four of those back. And then, like Josh said, Fierce is the new one I just wrote for that collection specifically.
Ghostwritten is supposed to arrive at my house today. The minute I went out and bought from the bookstore Blackmouth. That's another, and for listeners, these are all Ronald books. That's how, I can't explain how much I love They Lurk, but well, I can, I'm going to in the course of this hour. But to see that there was another collection of novellas right before it or recently before it, I was like, oh, hell yeah. And I didn't know that that's what it's about till you just said that. Now I'm like extra excited. Yeah. And also though, reading your, see, how do I say this? Like, you know, like Stephen King, it seems like every however many years it's a collection of novellas, right? Right. It seems like that. And it seems like it's kind of like that with most of us too. Like it's not a regular thing or, you know, but because you have those two close to each other and because They Lurk turned me on so much, I think my next book's going to be novellas again. Like, I'm just like, I'm in that place right now or something.
Well, this is cool, this, right? Because you're kind of championing the... I always imagined, right, that the novella would be a thing you sort of reacted to with dismay, that it's a short story that's kind of metastasized into something larger, or it's something that's fallen short of a novel. And then you kind of go, oh, fuck, how do I sell this, you know? And so it's cool that you're kind of both saying this is a like format that I love and want to pursue. But here's a question, because you just mentioned King. Do you think you need to be at a certain stage in your career for this to be a viable thing to release?
That's a good question. I never thought of it like that.
Well, okay. So my publishing history story is super bizarre. Let's not go through it all, but we will say this.
It's chronicled on previous episodes, guys. You can listen.
I had a stack of like 14 books written, and a friend from high school contacted me. He's like, I hear that you're doing like, you're like losing your mind in an office writing nonstop. Can I send one of your books to a lawyer friend that I know that represents authors? So I'm looking through, and I had Bird Box at the time, and I'm looking through these like 14 books or whatever it was. And I'm like, oh, Goblin. Because this is insane. Because if they don't like the first story, maybe they'll like the second. And if they don't like the second, like that's how little I knew. Not realizing that if he didn't like the first one, he's probably not going to read on, Josh, but that's okay. So I'm like, this gives me six times the chance of getting picked up or something, you know? So to answer your question, I sent Goblin thinking that there was a better chance of someone liking this. And I almost still feel that way. I feel like with the anthology and movies and books, it's almost like there's the star, the centerpiece, like the crate in Creepshow, right? It's sort of like the centerpiece, right? As time goes by, whatever the weakest link might have been to everyone at first, it almost becomes like endearing to us. The weakest link in the anthology, because it's still part of Creepshow, it's still part of Twilight Zone the movie or whatever, or Trick or Treat, whatever it is. So they help each other, the novellas. You have a centerpiece one and then maybe a weaker link, whatever. But by the end, it's like they're all on the same team or something. And so to me, that's one of the major appeals of anthology movies, is that each story sheds light on each other. Like if they made The Crate, well, then I'm going to also love Jordy Verrill because it's the same guys that made both, right? And so the same thing with the novellas. Now, in terms of, I think now, right now, absolutely you could sell a book of like novellas, because novellas seem like, I guess I don't like this word, but hot right now or something. Mm-hmm. Novellas are doing well. So I could absolutely see a horror author or an author come on the scene with all novellas right now for sure. But I do think for a long time, it wasn't like that. I think for a long time, it was like the short story collection, the novella collection is a harder sell.
Yeah.
So let's wait on that or something. But I think right now, absolutely, anything goes.
Yeah, I agree. I think everything does go. But it was tougher back in the day. I think with Josh's work, you have such a unique voice in every other story. It's very diverse. And I felt it again reading Black Yarn. I can understand why you as a writer are going to go, you know, here's one story. If you don't like, I get that mentality, because it's like, well, hey, I'm turning a different trick over here. Watch my hands, watch what I'm doing. And you do that constantly. So you almost like, you know, I've read all your work and it's, I could see how as an author, you like to push the narrative voice differently, even in with the context of a single book. So I can see how a novella collection for you lets you do that. And it's more fulfilling.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because these the first novellas I've read from you, Ron, and I've read Goblin, obviously, by you, Josh, you know. But in these collections, you both seem to play with what I think the closest thing to your familiar voices, if I can dare say that. Like, for example, Ronald, you have a story in this collection called The Separation.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say, okay, go on.
Feels completely different to me
than
anything I've read from you. It feels almost like frigidly cold. Whereas I think of your fiction as quite, weirdly, quite warm-blooded and warm-hearted, even when though bad shit happens. That sort of feels cold. And you, Josh, in Half This House Is Haunted, I hope you don't mind this comparison, it feels like you're literally sort of channeling a Paul Tremblay story. And it's this kind of indeterminate haunting. It's not a... That's the best I can think of, indeterminate. It's in the vein of Shirley Jackson, Paul Tremblay, and it feels very different from, often you write about things, you're kind of like a King-style writer, you know, it's like, here's real life, and then there's this mad shit that comes in and disrupts it, and Half This House Is Haunted feels much more slippery. So are you both actually taking a chance with novellas to play with what your baseline is?
Yeah, I mean, I do this. I do similar things with novellas that I do with short stories, is to kind of push the envelope on narrative voice and style to see where I want to go. I feel a little more responsible in a 500-page novel to stick to certain things I'm known for. But with the shorter form, I could kind of push it a little bit. You're on point, Neil, with, you know, like that a novella like The Separation, which was, you know, like I said, a few of those were written years ago, published years ago, and this book brings them back into print. But just like any writer, I mean, you go through these phases of writers that you read and you learn from, and you kind of emulate a little bit and mess with their style. And I was reading a lot of, I mean, I'm a huge unapologetic Ernest Hemingway fan, right? And he's got, his stories are populated by nothing but drunks, boxers, and people in Europe. So that's kind of where The Separation came from. And the beauty of what I find in Hemingway's stuff is it's always about unrequited love and regret and hardship and all these foibles that usually overcome the men in his story generally. But because these characters are so demonstratively reserved that the stories kind of come across a little cold. You have to read between the lines, you know, his iceberg theory of a telling a story. Just show the tip of the iceberg, let the reader fill in the rest. I kept that in mind when writing something like The Separation, where I wanted everything to sort of be below the surface and never turn all the cards over and show everything that's going on. And I feel it does that. Like even at the end with that reveal, I let it hang right there. Like I didn't want to go any further into that. While it's still my voice, it reflects who I was reading and the stuff I was trying to do at the time when that was written, which is a while ago now.
I want to hold the camera. You might be able to see it, but I've written a note when I was reading this months ago where I literally write down something Hemingway about the separation, a minimalist lyricism. And then I've put some quotes in. So I can't tell you how excited I am that you just mentioned Hemingway because I feel vindicated.
Dude, same thing. I didn't keep a note, but I thought it. And not just the separation, though. There's throughout the whole book, there's like, it's almost like it's like a refreshing, I don't want to say masculinity, but there is something refreshing about that. There's some like masculinity here, and that's great, and that's fine, and that's awesome. And it's like even inspiring to me. But the separation in me felt more like, what's his name? Like Blackwood. I know I use him a lot with you, but Blackwood and Henry James, like it felt like I'm like this like psychiatrist goes to visit this boxer on the outs, you know, who's lost all this weight. Oh, little brilliant things to me. Like that he's a flyweight, not a heavyweight. So like he lost weight, but he wasn't like Mike Tyson before, you know?
He's a little guy.
He's already like a little guy. Like little things like that I caught that I'm like, man, this is just brilliant. And I won't ruin anything. The end of the separation, and I think it was Skullbelly also, and maybe one more. But somehow you were able to give us like at the very end a moment, like an aha moment or like a what moment that didn't feel forced, that didn't feel like, and then, but I was like, oh shit, that just happened? And then it's over. So I feel like you ended the separation at exactly the right moment.
Man, it's funny you even notice that because when I was putting these novellas together, the collection together, what occurred to me as I was doing it is that each one of the first four, take the fifth one out of it, the first four, which were the reprints, each one ends at a place that you could argue the story should go on. But I feel that I gave enough information to put a cap on it and say, hey, think about it as you want beyond this, you know, and even with like, you know, something with Skullbelly, not to blow the ending on it, but like, you know, had I gone 20 more pages beyond where that story ended or had a different reveal when he's in that small town, you know, and march out Skullbelly like the beginning of those old Warner Brothers cartoons, they all come out on stage. The mystique is gone, you know, the tension dissipates. And I was aware that I wasn't doing that with any, like all of them kind of ended a place where they could keep going. And I kind of like that.
And how cinematic is the, how can I say this without ruining it? The look in the guy, in the kid's eye at the end of Skullbelly. If you can't see that on film, that moment, oh, it's brilliant. It's like the end of Carrie or something. It's so good, that moment, man.
Well, I'll tell you what, all I kept thinking about with Skullbelly, because for the listeners, Skullbelly is basically a cryptid urban legend.
It's like a Bigfoot-esque,
And I kept thinking, you know that film Antlers that came out a while back?
Yes, you see
that?
Know
and I hated that film, but I really love the short story it's based on, the name and author which it escaped me. But Skullbelly felt like a much better telling of that kind of story. You know, a kind of gritty, like masculine, you know, it's a private eye story end of the day.
Yeah.
It's sort of like a cryptid noir. That should be a genre.
it's so brilliant though. It's so brilliant because it's like a noir and it's just the Skullbelly part just kind of comes in just in a little moment when he's probably ill-advisedly having a drink outside. It's too cold to be on the balcony. Yeah. And this other guy's out there and like just kind of mentions this to him and then back to noir. And you're like, wait, hold on. What the fuck did that guy say outside?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good.
I want to come back to your stories, Josh, but while we're on Skullbelly, let me just ask Ronald this. It reads like a kind of authentic urban legend. And I, you know, I'm a sucker for this stuff. So please tell me it is. Or is it based on one? Or is it just like dredged from your imagination?
I made it up completely. Like I said, it's a playoff of Bigfoot. He's in the Pacific Northwest. It's this creature that lives in the woods that eats people. And, you know, he's got this distended stomach where the skin is so thin that you could see the skulls being digested in his stomach. I'm like, that's kind of cool. And yeah, I get why you'd want to see 7 movies made of that creature, you know, but like, and in my head, I kind of picture it a little bit like Pumpkinhead, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The way I was thinking about it. But no, it's completely fictionalized for me. I made it up for that story, but I felt so strongly about the urban legendness of it that I do mention it in Fierce, the last novella in that collection. You do, yeah. They reference her father references that. I'm like, I had to put that in there because it does, you know, and Josh, he does this a lot in his work too, where, you know, you kind of link those things together and you create a world bigger than the sum of all the parts that you're putting together. You know, it makes these stories bigger than themselves. There's a world beyond the book covers.
Well, it's incredible. It was one line in Fierce, one line.
Yeah.
And it somehow like unifies the whole book because you're referencing the story in the first. Also, the Skull Valley, the coolest part to me are his feet and how he and how he like gets up the tree. And I told Al, I went in the other room. I'm like, Allison, man, this story I'm reading is so good, man. It's about this thing. And I felt like I was like the nerdiest kid in the world. I'm like, it's got this like belly and it's like, you can see it digesting the skulls. And, you know, and she was like, right. this sounds awesome. I'm like,
but think about it. Like even so every urban legend you ever hear is you hear it. I don't think the three of us probably have not seen Bigfoot, but we've heard all these stories. Right. And so to kind of go into a story like Skullbelly, you know, you shouldn't be surprised at where I leave it at the end because it is that. It's a telling of an urban legend. I'm telling you, all those things that Josh described are things that are not necessarily witnessed firsthand by the reader reading the story, but it's told, you know, and that's, I think there's a beauty in characters in a story telling another story to someone else. That whole meta, you know, vibe of a story within a story. And I think that really works.
One of my favorite genres, stories where it feels like you've walked into a bar and someone is telling you this story.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I think there is some magic to that, a story within a story. Like the scariest book I've ever read, and I was like maybe 13 or so at the time, but was Stephen King's Pet Sematary, right? The only book that ever really scared me where I put it down, I had to go downstairs and hang out with my family, which was scary enough. But the two scariest parts in that book are the characters recounting the story of the sister Zelda and then Judd Crandall recounting the story of Timmy Baderman. Those are two characters telling another character's story. Mm-hmm. They're not scenes that King himself is giving us. And they're the two creepiest things in that book. And there's something about that wall.
You know, that's what the new movie is about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bloodlines. Yeah. That's about the Judd Crandall story.
But they're scary because they're being told to us by other characters. We're not seeing the scene unfold, and there's something inherently
Joseph Conrad is like, his books will like start off, two guys meet up, they're like in a boat or something, and one's like, let me tell you this, and the next 300 pages Let me ask you, just writer to writer, and you don't have to, you know, magician doesn't show their tricks, but were you aware of just placing it so casually on the balcony at the bar, whatever, when the artist, the drawer mentioned Skull Valley, were you very aware, like, I'm going to mention this, but like very casually, like, was that intentional or did you find yourself there and you're like, oh, this is a good spot? Like, I'm just curious.
I knew he was going to have that conversation with that guy. And as I was writing it, I was looking for a place to put him. And I knew he had to go to this bar to meet this police detective. So it kind of all worked out. But again, what I wanted is, you know, our PI through this story, you know, he catches glimpses of things. The story about the missing kids is weird. He goes to the woods, thinks he hears something in the trees. You know, all these things are kind of peripheral, right? It's not until he sees this guy who tells him the urban legend, which is how we all hear of urban legends. And I thought that was, for that story, it was perfect because that's how we all hear this stuff, and we're not shining the spotlight on a creature springing out from trees, right? And then, you know, I felt that once I got that payoff at the end where the kid starts screaming and, you know, a reader can go, oh shit, well, he's screaming because he saw this thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
and you know, you can kind of connect the dots. And I love a story that makes you it doesn't hammer you over the head. And then the last 20 pages you're reading going, yeah, I know. And you get to the end of the book. I like a story that you hit that last sentence and you take a pause and you're like, whoa, okay, this is what this means. I just figured it all out right here. Right. So yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking with that.
Have you ever heard of The Hide Behind before we move on? Because I kept thinking about this.
No.
Have you heard of The Hide Behind, George?
No, that's a great title, though.
Amazing.
It's one of these old trapper's tales. You know, there's a name for them. There's a name for that particular genre of folk tale told by loggers. And I can't remember what it is. It's like critter. Anyway, there's a name for it. The Hide Behind is one of the most famous ones from, like, the woods of old. And the idea was there was this creature that no one ever saw it because it was always hiding behind you. So every time you moved, it moved. It was always behind you until it ate you. And when I was, it's all I could think of when I was reading School Belly is The Hide Behind. I think it sounds comical. It'd make a great movie, right? The Hide Behind. What a gimmick. You never actually see the damn thing because it's always behind you. We mentioned, Josh, about Half of This House is Haunted, which at least in my proof of Spin a Black Yarn is the opening story. I kind of really tried to formulate a question about this and then couldn't, because it's such a, basically the idea behind your story is that it's like these siblings live in this house and they're haunted by their memories of this house pretty much for the rest of their lives, because the sister tells the brother that half of the house is haunted. And then you really start to play with what the word half means in that concept. And it's one of the most genuinely unnerving takes on a haunted house I've ever read, because when you start working with what different meanings of the word half is, you go from that room and that room. Oh, no, it could be that floorboard and that floorboard. And, like, basically, Josh, I don't have a question that really does justice to it. So just talk to me about this story.
I don't remember exactly where I was when the idea or the title of it came to me. And I pictured, just like I imagine most people probably picture, like a duct tape down the center of the house. And we got to stay over here because that side's haunted. And then I was like, no. Although that sounds fun too, by the way. that sounds like a fun story too. I guess Stephanie, and I don't want to ruin any, this is a hard one for me to talk about because of the ending of it. It's hard for me to not blow this. What she was doing the whole time and even aware of that as a kid, and then through the fact that she remains in this house and she seems like a nervous wreck by the time they're in their 40s and he shows up and she's like, you want a beer? You want to do this? You want to do that? Oh my God. Oh my God. How's the road? You know? And he's like, whoa, Stephanie is like fucking cracking up. But we understand by the end, kind of, this is a lifelong like endeavor that her in this house. Okay. So that concept is what like turned me on so much. Let's just say her letter at the end is what turned me on so much. Okay.
Okay.
So couple that with her trying to scare her brother and trying to get him to face what she's facing. How about that? It's a hard one. Listeners, it's a hard one to talk about without blowing.
As soon as I read the first sentence, I go, oh, this is how he's telling this story. It's the framework of this story that for me just knocks it out of the park, because you know, you're, again, going back to that novella form, it's short enough where you can get away with doing this bouncing act. You couldn't carry that. Well, maybe Josh could. I couldn't carry that for 500 pages telling a story like that. But the novella is the perfect form. And Josh, is as soon as I read that first sentence, I go, yes, I know why people are talking about this thing. This is the way you tell this story. Yeah.
Well, Argyle, there's no, I think you have a story as well. Which one is it? Is it The Stranger or The Separate? No, I think it's The Stranger. Where there's no chapter breaks.
Right?
It's all the way through. Right. Yeah. Argyle is like that too. That would be really hard to pull off in a novel. I mean, right. I actually have done that, and the rough draft of Bird Box was like that. But that's a bigger thing to ask, I think, of a reader, like, hey, no breaks. Again, now I want to do this like so bad. But no breaks for 500 pages. But in 180, 100, 120, why not? And so, yeah, you can like get away with those. You could get away with it in the whole novel too. I just want to say, I don't know why I feel compelled to say this, because all this talk about the novella, that the novel is home for me. Like, it's home, like, over the script, over the short story, over the novella, over poem, over anything, it's home. So when I'm talking about, I just almost feel compelled to say that for something.
No,
so
man, and I agree with you 100%. I mean, that's where I'm most comfortable too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Well, let me say something that might be a bit, I don't know. I don't know if this might be a bit annoying even, but on the whole, there are exceptions to this in either case. In They Lurk, Ronald, I think all of those stories could be novels, all those novellas, but they couldn't be short stories. Whereas I think your stories, Josh, could be short stories, but couldn't be novels.
Oh, that's cool.
Feels like you start with this really neat idea, Josh, and then the idea is almost too big for a short story and it needs more depth. And it feels like you, Ronald, are taking what is quite a bigger idea and going, right, how can I make it into a little hard diamond of an idea and cut the fat, you know? So it's interesting that you both say you're more comfortable in novels, because it feels like you're coming from different directions on this.
So basically what you're saying is we're both really writing novels. Josh is expanding his short fiction and I'm cramming a novel down, so, but we're both still doing what we do. I'll go with that.
I think what it's about is focus, because I think what distinguishes a really great novella from a good or a mediocre one is the writer's ability to deliver sort of character and emotion and ideas, all of it in a confined word length without it feeling shortchanged, you know, because I read a lot of novellas that have got a really strong concept, but they never somehow amount to more than a delivery tool for that concept. And as a result, they kind of feel like gimmicks sometimes, like they don't take flight. Whereas in all of these stories, there is an idea and there is character, and sometimes one is bigger than the other, but they're both there. And that's a very long-winded way to ask a very broad question, which is how do you take the format of the novella and pack all that stuff in and make it so the story is whole? How do you do that? Because so many people can't do it.
Well, I think the point is to, you know, even when I'm under contract to do a novella collection, so I know I got to write another novella, I sit down and I write a story and I kind of let it go. And if any one of those novellas, you know, desired to be 400 pages and turn into a novel, I would let it. I wouldn't chop its legs out. I just kind of organically let it do its thing. I don't outline any of this stuff. I just kind of roll with it and see where it goes. And yeah, a couple of those could have gone beyond where I've ended them, but I also like there's two things with it. Like I said, I like the idea of saying, hey, it just moves quickly the way it is, and there's enough here for our reader to figure out what happens beyond the page once I stop telling. So that's number one. Number two is similar to like I was saying with Josh, who I sense that he explores various tonal shifts and voices and stuff in his narration in his shorter work. I find the ability to say, to kind of say, you know what, let me If I alienate or piss off some readers with this ending, that's okay. I'm willing to take that chance on a novella that's in a collection of multiple novellas, as opposed to a 500 page novel where I'm going, you know what, fuck the ending. I'm not to say that I didn't give all those endings thought. I probably gave them too much thought and built the story around that ending. But yeah, I mean, I guess to answer your question is I let these stories kind of be what they want to be. And I don't really say, okay, I got to do, this has got to be 20,000 words as opposed to 90, or, you know, I kind of let it be more organic.
I have like what I call like the list. I should come up with a more original name than the list. But it's like a list of all these ideas. Right. And typically I just try to like go down them, because to wait for one to jump out or to inspire more than another, once I get into any one of these, the reason for them to have made the list means that I'm excited about it. So once I get into any of them, let's roll. So even okay. But sometimes I'll look down that list and I'm like, okay, how many, like, is this a novel? I mean, or how about this? Sure, it could be, but could it also be a novella? Could it also be, is there a version of each? Yeah, yeah. I think there's also that to this, right? Is that there isn't necessarily only one way to tell the story, right?
Right.
I would prefer, I guess, in a sense, that they were all novels, because that's, again, that's right. Home. And I love, Ronald, what you said about it's okay for the boom mic to show. It is okay for them to be a little clunky, or, all right, you went off and you said all this. Okay. But there's something like classy about the novella. And there's something like classy to me about the novella collection in the same way, like maybe like classic, like, again, the first horror movies I ever saw were Twilight Zone, the movie Creepshow, Creepshow 2, and then like the Amicus stuff. So my introduction to horror was all anthology, shorter stuff like this. And there's just something like classy, like you almost imagine between each book, like between each story in They Lurk, you imagine like, like blackness, fog, and then now a new story emerges and with new characters. And there's just something so like horror, ooh, like Tales from the Dark Side. Okay, well, what's next? Mm-hmm. You know? So I just try to find like which of those, and I'm already thinking about that for another book, which of those can be told that way. And I think that's maybe sometimes I picked wrong. Right. Now, I think Spin a Black Yarn is fine. But I think sometimes like I've picked wrong before where I'm like, I'm going to make a novel out of this one. And then I'm like 50,000 words in and I'm like, what am I doing? You know? So, like, so, you know, but that's all of that. Those gambles are fun.
Yeah. I mean, you see a lot of chat, don't you? There's a lot of conversation in literary circles about if something can be shorter, it should be shorter. There's a lot of snobbery about the novel, about it being all indulgent and all that. And I'm
the wrong guy to say that to. Yeah.
Yeah. I like the indulgence, you know, and
me too.
And I think the word probably is texture. And this goes back to my point about it's not just an idea. It's a genuine story. And there is a difference, an important difference there. And I think the two stories that really make my point here is Skullbelly, which we've talked about, and Argyle, which is a story from your collection, Josh, which I think is the neatest idea in this. It makes me smile, Argyle, because it's basically about a guy on his deathbed with his family gathered around. He's a loving, you know, a sitcom type dad who then just tells them that he's really not the man they think he is. And I'll say no more, but I love the purity of that idea.
I have never read a story in any format that has balanced humor and horror the way that Argyle does. And he, like how the guy keeps talking over people when they're getting ready. I'm like, like it's hilarious. And not only do you balance that, and I'm not going to give anything away, but you know, your last page on that story, you know, the end of that, I'm like, motherfucker threw heart in there too. I'm like, he got me. He got like it. This whole thing just came together so well. So yeah.
But by definition, I mean, that story has to have meat on the bone, otherwise it's meaningless. So there's a scene where his friends come to visit, and I'm always interested by the parts of stories that are not sort of narratively essential, because why are they there? So his friends come to visit, and he's quite rude to them, you know, and he gives, like, there's this woman who's been in his life throughout, and her character is fleshed out more than it absolutely needs to be. And in Skullbelly, Ronald, there's a funny conversation with an old man in a waiting room and another conversation about playing the trumpet, which made me laugh. I suppose what I'm asking is, when you're working within this shape, how do you decide which darlings to kill and which to keep? Because it's surely there's more pressure on it than there would be if you're just going, right, I'm going to write a 500-page novel. How do you make the call?
For me, it's like music. Honestly, it is. It's like, does this beat, like, is this element taken away from the beat? No. All right, let's leave it. Is it a cool, like, guitar riff suddenly? Is it a horn blast? Is it a great lyric? Like, as long as the rhythm of the story remains, a lot of things, for me, can dance on top of that beat. I think it was Mrs. Dalloway was the first book that I read where I realized that the entire book doesn't have to be about the idea. Mm-hmm. Like I read on the back of the book, this is the book that splits the atom. It's about a woman preparing for a party. And then I read Mrs. Dalloway and it was like a third of it was that. But there were like a bunch of other things happening. And it was, I love the book, blah, blah, blah. But that was the one that opened my eyes to, hey, when you write a novel, dude, it doesn't all have like, you know, it's about two people falling in love. Every scene doesn't have to be the two people falling in love.
Right.
Right. Like, right. Mm. You're saying the trumpet thing or whatever, these elements, to me, that's like colorful. It's like adding a harmony here. It's like adding a cymbal hit here. It's like, I don't even know if they're darlings to be killed. It's just like slashes of color to me.
I mean, there are things that you put in there to, like, every writer does it differently. Like with me, like the trumpet or the man in the waiting room, I look at elements. Like, we all know what a school or classroom looks like, right? So I'm not going to describe the classroom and say there's desks lined up and there's a chalkboard and there's windows. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say, you went into the classroom, there was a half-eaten apple on the floor. Because we already know what the classroom looks like, so I'm giving you the apple as set dressing to say, okay, here's something unique. Huh. So waiting room stuff, the PI who used to be a former cop, now plays the trumpet on the side. Those are things that color that story. And that's how I do it. But like to go back to Josh's story, Argyle, the character Quinn, the friend, no real description beyond that they were friends and used then vacationed together about this guy, except he's the one guy who doesn't leave the room. Like, he wants to hear this stuff even when his wife. And I'm like, that paints more of a picture without saying anything, Josh, than any description could, because I'm like, and he's like, no, go on. And he'll tell the kids to leave, but the dude's not going anywhere. I think he only gets up to give like the grandmother his seat at the end. I'm like, this guy wants to hear this stuff. And yeah. I think that colors, there's your character right there without saying anything. It's brilliant. So yeah, that was freaking great.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned rhythm, Josh, right? And this conversation, I could derail this conversation by asking you this now, because I know what you're both like, because of, we spent 10 minutes listening before this interview just talking about guitars. But you're both in bands. Music's a big part of both of your life. You know, it's not even a side gig, right? It's a big part of your life. And I kept thinking about that. I kept thinking about, well, for a start, I'm getting you together, so I need to ask you about music and how it fits into your writing. But then I was thinking about the novella and about music. I kept thinking about, you know, you get sort of those odd little songs that don't really fit with an album, but they're too good to cut off. And the one I kept coming back to, this is a nice 30-year-old reference for my younger listeners, but you know Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill?
Yeah.
If you listen right to the end and let it play, there's a hidden track about a stalker. You know, I'll take a shower in your shower and sleep in your bed and stay after. It's quite a creepy, haunting song. And I want to ask you about, you know, how music plays a role in your writing, but also, do you feel like novellas are that chance to, you know, that little weird thing perhaps on the end of an album, that thing that is a bit kooky and, you know, a bit odd and offbeat?
I would say no. I feel like I want the, it's hard. Of course we want the novella to be as good as anything we're writing. Mm-hmm. I actually don't really see the novella as like taking more like chances. I don't, because I feel like, oh my gosh, like Ghoul in the Cape is 300,000 words. And that's, I can't imagine. Like, I mean, that's where I decided to do more of that. Maybe I don't really see it that way. I see it like, I don't really know how to express that. Musically, I would say if you think of the short story as a, I hate this pop song, okay. Yeah. But if you think of it as an album song, and then the novella is maybe an album side, and a novella and a novel is the full album.
Okay, that works. That works. Yeah. Yeah.
So a song like Echoes by, you know, Pink Floyd, Echoes, that takes up a whole album side. So that's a novella. Whereas Free Four is a single or a short story, and then Dark Side is a novel. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've gone to Bruce Springsteen immediately on this, but yeah, I still the thing still maps across. Yeah, well, I mean, whilst I've got you both together, let's briefly, because I know what you're like, briefly talk about music, right? Because maybe that's the secret. Maybe that's why you are so good at working in all three forms. Maybe it is a command of rhythm, and I'm not using a like creaky metaphor. Maybe that's it. Does rhythm play a part in how you write?
Absolutely. I mean, I feel cadence and rhythm and beat in the language I use, and when I have an editor go through something and they edit it so parochially, where it's like, well, we don't need this line because the audience understands this. I'm like, no, you need the line because I'm saying bop bop bop. Bop, 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 bop. And that's exactly, yes. I know, Josh, you did it. There's yes. a, Every one of your novellas in Spin a Black Yarn does that. You've got paragraphs that are one word long. Yes, it's all about that beat. So I'm very aware of doing that. I know when something sounds to use a musical reference in a story, when a chorus comes to conclusion and that final chord settles, that works in fiction too. And I hear that.
Yep, 100%. Bird Box is a good example for me where it literally felt like one beat the entire, the entire novel writing experience. And it doesn't always feel like that. A rough draft. Okay, like I think I've said this to you before, but it's true. Every time I sit down to write a novel, I almost imagine like an invisible drummer behind me, right? So he or she is playing and I'm like, all right. And like Ronald, I'm the rhythm guitarist and the high strung. And our bass player is way more of a lead than I am. So I'm very used to like staying home with Derek, like a Steve Cropper. Right. And so Chad's doing his thing. So that rhythm guitar player thing, okay, I'm going to keep the rhythm with you, drummer, for this story. And I think Bird Box succeeded in that way. And I feel like you could almost play like one note, literally one note through all of Bird Box and it would work. And even if you added a second note, you might ruin the whole mood, right? Mm-hmm. But other ones, you'll do the rough draft and blah, blah, blah. And when you go back and read it later, you're like, look at your drummer. You're like, were you playing jazz? what the hell is this, man? You know, like, you're like, oh, Ronald, you mentioned jazz in, I think, four of the stories or three?
Probably, yeah.
So I was going to ask, are you like a big jazz fan?
I'm a huge jazz fan.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Okay. Davis Coltrane. I had a chance to see Dave Brubeck like a month before the guy died. I would have loved to have seen that. I listen to jazz. I listen to everything, you know. And I used to listen to jazz a lot when I was writing. So probably a lot of those earlier stories were influenced by the music I was listening to then. But funny how you're talking about the beat of a story. So what comes to mind actually is when I was writing the novellas for Ghostwritten, and I would listen to music. Usually I kind of go to like horror movie soundtracks, like on vinyl when I'm writing. Right. And I'll keep that in the background. Just these really kind of, you know, tonal scores that are playing. But if I get to a scene where it's just, I'm getting that the story's got its own beat, I'll get up and shut the music and I'll sit down and let the story have the music. Right. And that's where I know I'm like in that little sweet pocket when I'm writing.
I ran into with Incidents Around the House, that's coming out next year. I ran into where I was like, what music? And then for the first time ever, I was like, why don't we just listen to the house? First time ever. I like turned off everything and turned off the lights.
Cool.
And it was just like so dead silent at night. And I'm like, oh, this is good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just want to say one thing. So in the event that I do come back to a rough draft where it feels like the rhythm's all over the place, inclination is to try to force that into four on the floor, but maybe not. Hold on. Maybe find the beat that drummer was playing. Maybe you got something original here. And I think it's a lot of us enter a rewrite assuming we're going to dislike what we wrote, assuming we're going to be like, oh man, what were we thinking? And you will feel that way, but maybe also give that rough draft a second. Like, were you doing something refreshing here? Were you doing something unique here? And maybe you were, and maybe that drummer was playing 11-9 beat or whatever the hell it is. And why don't you find that beat first, then look at it from that angle? And I think Ghoul in the Cape is something like that for me. Unburied Carol was something like that for me. And whereas Daphne, Bird Box, Carpenter's Farm are four on the floor. But I want to play all different kinds of songs, like the Beatles, like all of our favorite bands. I don't want to have just one groove, right? And so just a word of advice to a listener, I suppose, is that yes, you're gonna be embarrassed when you go to rewrite by what you have written before. But also, hold on, just look at it like maybe some of this was intentional and good. Also,
this is all this has been a good episode for actual writing advice. Write about the apple, not the classroom.
And, oh, I love that. Yeah,
take a free jazz approach to your first draft. I'm a big fan of this. I think listeners will like this. But the one thing I do want to ask you, Josh, in particular, is all of the stories in Spin a Black Yarn, they all take place, or no, they all reference a town called Sam Hatton, which we then find out is quite close to Goblin. And if just little, if listeners want to know a bit more about Goblin and Josh's weird little town, go listen to episode 39. And like the thing with Skullbelly, with you, Ronald, that gets mentioned, I'd forgotten to pick up, but you mentioned the connective tissue in Ghost Written. Are they just flourishes, or are they a necessary part of anthologizing for you?
Wow.
I think they, well, first of all, I want to say what I thought you were going to say about Josh's stories is four of the five of his stories in Splint and Black Yarn are extremely claustrophobic because they all take place in one location. And I wanted to know if that was deliberate, like a house, a bedroom, a tube in a house, and then a glass box, right? In Jupiter. I'm like, is this, how deliberate was this? Like,
well, that's a better question than mine. So my work here is done.
Well, no, I'm just like, as a reader, I pick up on it. As a writer, I look at that and I'm like, man, thematically, this is an extremely claustrophobic book, you know?
Yeah.
Was that on purpose or?
Like, okay. So like I said, there was,
I totally fucked your question, Neil. I'm sorry.
No,
we'll get back to it.
I wrote them all in a row. And so, again, following that rhythm, right? And so me and my friends, we do theatrical readings of the books.
Right.
And I was like, oh, man. I realized what you're talking about now, I was like, dude, we could rent five rooms in a row of like a motel. Mm-hmm. And the first room, we decorate half the house is haunted. Then there's there's Sean Hasbro dying in the second room. Then there's Doug and Judy in the tube in the third room. And the guy falling through Jupiter, Steve falling through Jupiter. I can't believe I remember all their names. Steve falling through Jupiter. And then even the two brothers haunting Igorov in his house in the last room. Yeah. Intentional or not, following the beat. Yeah.
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 That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I'll actually flip that around, because the sort of, just like Josh's stories are all connected by claustrophobia, the thing that, there's a kind of similar difference in your stories, Ronald, in that they all take place in very different parts of the world. So like one's in Germany and the rest are all across the contiguous United States. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't picked up on the claustrophobia thing, but I did think about that with you, that you don't return to one scene of the crime. You don't return to one region. Every story is a different place.
That's unusual for me. I mean, I write a lot of my stuff that takes place in Maryland.
Yeah, I know. I wondered why you ventured off in so many different directions.
Skullbelly, because I was aping the Bigfoot mythos, so I put it in the Pacific Northwest. The Boxer in Germany, I don't know why I put him there. I don't know what I was thinking at the time. You know, it was less about the locations, but more about, you talk about like with Josh and his, and the theme of that claustrophobia that I got from the book. With mine, when I put those first four novellas together, they're all male protagonists. They're all very masculine stories. They're all arguably misogynistic in the way the male characters are in those stories. And I tend to find that naturally when I write men in general, or men that I know maybe in real life, they tend to be less available to confront their fears, their problems, the issues that they deal with. They're very happy to put blinders up. You know, and I find when I write those characters that they got a lot of trauma and a lot of issues that they just kind of put blinders up. And I noticed I did that a lot with those characters in those first four stories, which kind of suits the ending of each of those first four stories, where they are, I'm letting you know how I'm suggesting their ending, but I'm not going to go into detail of it, because these men don't go into detail of this stuff. They're very insular and almost too testosterone heavy, right? In some of in how they think. And to juxtapose that final novella, Fierce, is told from the point of view of a teenage girl. And I did the opposite of what I did in all the other four novellas, which is I give that story a pat resolution. I let her address not only the issues she's dealing with in that current story, but the past trauma from her when she was a younger kid with her mother, and how that she's reflective on that stuff, where my male characters are not. And each one of those male characters are kind of doomed to some degree in a cycle. The boxer, the doctor who comes to help him, the guy in the car who, you know, in the separate or in the stranger, who is really, that whole story is just a metaphor for this guy's broken relationships and how he keeps this cycle going, all of that stuff. And even with Skullbelly, where it's just a PI kind of going about his day job, once he learns at the end of that story, once he learns and this kid screams and he sees the picture and all this stuff, what does he do? He quietly leaves the house and doesn't address anything beyond that, right?
Oh, I love that.
He slips out. And that's how all the men in these stories react. And I did, and I completely wanted to turn it on its head for the last novella for this. Mm-hmm. Teenage girl point of view, you know, conclusionary, facing trauma, dealing with it, overcoming it. And I felt that was a nice little balance because it's so different from the other four.
I want to say again, the masculinity of those first four stories was like refreshing. It really was for me. Like, dude, I love everything. I love, so do you. I'm sure all three of us love everything. And I feel like it's been a minute since I read something with some Hemingway masculinity. And it was freaking nice. You know?
Well, that's like, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, and then as you were saying, Fierce kind of washes the blackboard at the end, but still completely jives. Like all, because you were saying before, the first four stories were published. When you say years ago, by the way, you're not talking that long ago. It's not like, you know, like 5 years ago?
They were published between 2009 and 2012.
Oh, so. 2009. Okay, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
okay,
they go back.
That's a minute. Yeah. Okay, okay. I don't, aside from maybe what we're talking about right now, I don't really notice any time gap between them. Like the Valor completely feels unified to me. I can't imagine it'll ever feel that way to you because you have a relationship with these four. But to someone who just came to this, it feels like completely like you could have wrote them all in the same.
Thank you. I'm glad. I'm relieved.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm going to wrap it up with a slight tweak on the normal closing questions, because Christ, Josh, we've plumbed your fears and insecurities enough times on this show already. You know what I mean? So, but first of all, what I want to know is, do you have a favorite novella?
It's hard to pick one, man.
That Peter Straub book, Houses Without Doors, is pretty incredible. I can't remember the names of all the stories in there. There's that real weird one about the travel guide. Welcome to our town. And it's got like...
That is
like,
a weird collection. That is a really strange collection. I love that.
It's a great weird one, like super colorful. I don't know. My favorite, I don't know. But I mean, I think honest to God, one of my... Like the book I just read might include my favorites. I'm not... Like I'm going to be talking about They Lurk for... That's like this is a go-to for me now. Like I absolutely love this book. A novella that I read recently is Bloom by Delilah Dawson.
Yeah.
And it was great. The writing is so good. And the relationship between these two women is so unsettling. And I think it's a novella. I mean, or it's a really short book.
Oh, well, let's not have that conversation. Let's not get into that. That's a whole Twitter minefield at what's a novella or not. Jesus, no one needs that. But what about you, Ronald? Because I have a guess on what you're going to say based on one of these stories, but I could be wrong.
Well, you know what? Because I love his really dense novel so much, Peter Straub does not immediately jump to mind. But as soon as Josh said that, he has got some fantastic novellas. He really does. I mean, the guy was, he's probably my favorite, my favorite writer, really. He was great. You know, I'd be remiss to not talk about Josh and his stuff. And I know everybody was, I mentioned this to him yesterday in a message, but I heard a lot about Half This House Is Haunted, and I said something like, look, if they're not teaching Doug and Judy by the House Washer in school, like years from now.
Oh, we haven't talked about that.
It is so, what took me by that story, and a lot of Josh's work does this for me, is the conceit is so obvious that you wouldn't think a writer would be able to pull it off. That is a perfect example of like Josh doing Josh's magic trick. And it works so well. And even when you are just so invested in the metaphor and get where this couple's coming from, you know, you do create a sense. I mean, they're terrible people, but you create a sense of compassion towards the end of this. And a lot of these stories do that. Like I said, I was very surprised to, you know, go in there and see your balance of of comedy and horror that ended with a sense of heart on some note. And I'm like, man, this is just, these are great tricks. These are great, you know, writers should study how this is done.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. But look, The Long Walk, Stephen King. I love that novella. You know, can I not say Turn of the Screw? I mean, that probably has informed to some degree everything I've done at some point, right? Henry James, Turn of the Screw. At some point, there's something of that bleeds into something I do. Mm-hmm.
Very much in the separation, but also The Long Walk is my favorite novella probably ever. But well, we haven't discussed Doug and Judy Bought the House Washer, which I'll come to very briefly in a second. But you have a story in this collection that we haven't talked about called The Fade. After The Fade, sorry, yeah, After The Fade. And it's kind of like your version or you're working on similar sort of rails to Stephen King's The Mist, right? Like a load of, and I just kept thinking The Mist. I just kept thinking, I thought he must love The Mist. But what I love about After The Fade that even King doesn't do in The Mist is you write this novella, and this is not a spoiler because no one knows what I mean, but right at the end, you realize the entire thing's a rug pull. And what you've read is a prologue to an epic novel.
Yeah.
And I was just like, the audacity of that.
I know. Dude, The Separation and, After the Fade. Those two end exactly like an entire novel could follow that moment. Yeah.
Well, and I recognize that, but even with After the Fade, I'm like, okay, but does anybody want to really read that novel? Because I think a million people have written that novel already. I just like that idea. And really, I didn't know I was going to end that way when I first started it. But as I was writing it, and I kept going back to that opening paragraph about the whole metaphor of After the Fade, when a band plays a song on a record, and instead of just coming to a hard stop, the music just kind of fades out. And I always used to think, I'm like, if it didn't fade out, what would I hear? Would I hear them putting their guitars down? Would I hear the drum stool being kicked over? Like all that stuff. And I'm thinking of that as I'm writing this thing. And I'm like, well, that's sort of the metaphor for the end of the world. It's sort of like, look, we'll, you know, does it end with a bang or a whimper? And I think it's a line I use from Eliot in that story. And that's kind of what carried me through. So when I was midway through, I'm like, oh, you know how I'm going to end this? I'm going to end it with a beginning. And that's kind of what I liked about that idea.
Yeah, but I don't even understand. Like that element didn't exist. Like with three sentences to go, that element didn't exist. And then by the end of the story, it's like, oh shit, that's what this was. Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
It's one of the most audacious endings to a story I've ever read. Yeah. I was grinning and cursing you at the same time.
Yeah, I know. So
there's no question here, Josh, but just to say that like, Doug and Judy Bought the House Washer. It's been when your book came out, there was like a sort of like an overwhelming love for that story from everyone. All the reviews I read, everyone really loved that story. And for the listeners, it's basically about this quite obnoxious affluent couple who buy a house washer where they sit inside it and the house fills with cleaning fluid and it cleans the house. But things happen while they're in there that kind of quite physically show them the downside of their route to where they are in life, shall we say. It's a bit of a flashback. The bones of their life are being shown to them, and that is in a nutshell what I'm talking about when I say that some novellas are gimmicks and some transcend that, because that could so easily just be, here's this cool device we've got, but you fill it with somehow with texture and this kind of pathos for these horrible people. And I think that's what I'm talking about when I say that a great novella as opposed to a good novella has that additional stuff, really, you know.
You know, there's this one moment in Doug and Judy where Doug, I mean, they're going after each other the whole time, but where Doug points out something that she did, terrible thing that she did, that wasn't on the ladder, wasn't on the rise, wasn't on the way up. Like Judy, that, like anything goes in us climbing the ladder, but this one wasn't on the ladder, man. That was just flat out evil, you know. Like this had nothing to do with you. Like we could ruin those around us if they're in our way. That girl wasn't even in our way, Judy, you know. And it's like that's when it started to feel like, ugh. But at the same time, Judy, to me, there's something like she had a chance to be all right. I get a sense that she kind of did want to go off with her buddy, with that the hippie friend that's writing her and stuff.
But she kept the letters,
She kept the letters, and you just get this idea that she's like, oh, she's so dumb, this tree hugger, and you're kind of like, no, you're like this close to have going with her. Mm-hmm. With Doug, I don't know that he had, and I don't think there's any chance he was going to go anywhere else, but.
I got that same vibe from Judy, and my takeaway was, she, this doesn't give anything away, but she takes the wrong binder into the tube with them, which when she reveals what's in the binder, my mind goes back to this thing was sitting out in the first place. She must have been looking at it, right? And kind of thinking back on that stuff. And I think that's what I'm saying. Those are the threads that you don't hit your audience over the head with that. But when you're a reader can make those connections and go, well, to accidentally pick up this binder and carry it in, it had been out, you had been looking through it, you had been thinking and reminiscing about what could have been or what should have been, as opposed to where you are now. The other thing, Josh, I think you do great in that story. Two things. One is, you don't bog us down with how any of this shit works with the house washer, which is great. It's just so nebulous that it's perfect. But I also love the fact that the things from their past, without being specific, but the things from their past that come to them, they never say, I threw that in the fireplace. I destroyed it. Or I threw that in the trash. It shouldn't be here. There's never any element of supernatural really to it. It's just their psyche working, because they always say, oh, I got rid of, or I thought I got rid of that, or I put it in a box somewhere. And so you keep it grounded where this is really just these people's psyches working on them, you know? And I thought that was really well done,
man. I feel like all of us could imagine like, I've been to a party like at Doug and Judy's house, you know. I've been to a party where they're showing everyone the house washer, and I'm like, you know, when Allison and I, we first moved into the first house we ever like rented, and it was like so big, and I mean, at the time it seemed unbelievably big, and we were walking around, and at some point we were like, oh, we're gonna have to like clean this place, and we were like we were standing in the living room, we didn't have any furniture in there yet or anything. And I was like, imagine. And then I described like the house washer, right? And all of our stuff is like floating around us. And you and I just get to sit here while our house is clean. And then I started picturing like, but what if like some bad shit, like not that we've done, but what if some bad shit was swirling out there? And then I was like, okay. So for like 7 years now, I've been talking whenever the house needs to be cleaned, I'm like, why don't we just get the house washer? And then whatever, a year ago, I was like, okay, time to write this story.
Yeah. That's great, man. Nah, that was probably my favorite one in the whole thing. I thought it was
right on. Yeah. Awesome.
Well, you know what? This has been a great conversation, and I'm not going to bring it to some squealing false hope by asking the normal closing questions, because you've answered those questions before. So I'm just going to leave it there in this beautiful kind of firework display of mutual appreciation. I haven't been necessary this week at all. I could have just turned this on and gone and walked my dog. But honestly, you can tell from what both of these guys are saying, they love each other's work. I think these stories are like some of the most fun I've had reading all summer. And as I keep, I keep banging this drum on this show that like fun is not, in horror terms, fun is not kind of false or diminished praise. It's a really, really important thing. And I had a great deal of fun reading them. I just wish I'd read them closer to this interview, so I could have been a bit more insightful.
No, but
you both asked better questions than me.
Before we end this, allow me to say this, because you just brought up something so meaningful to me, that you can come from a place of joy, or a story can be fun, and that doesn't mean that it's like Pollyanna. That doesn't mean that it's optimistic. That means that there's like a vitality there. Like Ronald's stories, they're super fun, but it's not like you're like, ha, 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 ha. No, I mean, there's emotional, you're emotionally wrecked with this one. Man, during Fierce, I was losing my mind. I wanted to write you guys. I was going to write you being like, oh, come on, man, come on. Like, she's going to be all right, right? She's going to be all right. You know, that moment, that I don't even really understand the moment where the Errol's whatever.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when they look across the street and he's almost, is he looking down at the tire or the tires or whatever? Mm-hmm. There's just something so... Like, it's almost like the monster's just waiting for them to walk over to him or something. And but I didn't know that at that moment. And then I see that in hindsight. Anyway, it's important to me that these phrases, like, coming from a place of joy, that I'm an optimist, that you say these stories are fun. That doesn't, we're not talking about some, like, baloney positive heartstring thing. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, like, an energy, a vitality, a juice to it, like an awesome, like metal music is dark and it's fun as hell.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, Josh, I think you and I, one of us sent a text yesterday about this, the same thing, but it's like, you know, this stuff is, I still think of it as art. I mean, you're creating art when you're writing a book, but you're also creating entertainment, which is fun. And this is, you know, the biggest joy I get from doing this stuff is to find the personal satisfaction of creating a piece of art that other people enjoy. And that's really it, you know?
Well,
and
I think a thing that would convince a lot of people or explain it is Stephen King is fun.
Yes.
Yeah. Like when you pick up a book of his, like, you're thrilled. You're so excited.
It's not a chore. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, we enjoy it. Right.
And that doesn't mean that the book you're about to read is some like puff piece. It just means that there's an energy to it. And hopefully in our case, it's like a dark, a dark flowing energy with an awesome drummer.
Who's playing that 11-9? Yeah.
Oh, God. They're off again. I'm going to kill it there. Right, guys. As ever, always a complete pleasure to speak to you. They Lurk, Spin a Black Yarn, both out now, been out for a while. Get a hold of them. And Ronald, Josh, thank you for talking Scared.
Thank you, guys.
Loved it.
Both of you. Thanks.
Yep. Thank you.
You know, I could have really done with a week off this week. I've had, like, the birthday festivities, I've had, like, deadlines coming out of my backside, and, you know, I just wasn't needed, was I? I could have just set the call up, let those two talk, and gone about my business. It would have been a win-win for everyone. Josh's love for this stuff is always infectious. I come out of every conversation with him, and there's been a few now. I leave every conversation wanting to just read all the books, talk about all the movies, and listen to all the music. And I expected Ron to be a steadying, stoic presence. But no, he was just as bloody enthusiastic. I really, really enjoyed both of these novella collections, but seemingly not as much as they enjoyed each other's. What an absolute loving this turned out to be. It did make for a nice conversation, though, didn't it? And maybe the first I've ever had that touched on both Pet Sematary and Mrs. Dalloway. It was also nice to do an episode that contained so much useful craft advice, because I always like to pack that in, but I don't like to force it. There are other shows for that, you know. But Ron's bit about describing the apple, not the classroom, feels invaluable, especially for someone like me, whose main problem is overwriting and the urge to describe every fucking thing the character sees. Equally, Josh's point about reading first drafts generously feels like the right approach, because maybe chaos can be fruitful, maybe missteps spur originality. Listening back to this episode for the edit, I actually feel more inspired to get back to my own writing than I have in about a year. I'm still primarily focused on the non-fiction Talking Scared book idea. Publishers, call me. But maybe I'll try to resurrect the Quarry novel. Who knows? It's still in there, burning around in my synapses, saying, write me, write me. Speaking of novels, Josh mentioned Pen Pal in passing at the start of the conversation as an example of a novel that manages to sustain the horror of a shorter work. And I can't believe that I missed the chance to talk to him and Ron about that book, because I love that book. If you haven't read Dathan Auerbach's Pen Pal, then, well, I can't give you a strong enough recommendation. It began as a series of Reddit posts, quite creepypasta-ish, but then he turned it into this connective tissue of stories, all about a boy looking back and trying to untangle his weird childhood memories. And the resolution, or the reveals, are supremely chilling. It's a wonderful book. You know, maybe, even though it's not anywhere near the classic status of some novels. Maybe it's worth a deep dive. I don't know. I know that Laura Senf has read it recently. What do you think, Laura? Did it scar you? Ron mentioned stories within stories, and I agreed that I love them as a genre, but the conversation spun on once again. Was I even needed? I will just say that if you want to read those kinds of nested narratives, there's obviously King, and From a Buick 8 is a great example of him working in that shape. But I'd also point you to Michael Marshall Smith, who I think does that man at bar telling you a weird tale better than anyone I've read. His collected stories is a big bumper masterclass in that kind of casual anecdotal approach. And he was on the show way back in episode 19. So go give that a listen and read his stories. It is nice to have this chance to point you to other books mentioned, because that was always the original intent of these outros, to give you homework. If you have any thoughts on anything we've discussed, from your favourite novella to your favourite type of guitar, get in touch. I'm at Talk Scared Pod on almost all the social medias, or you can email me at talkingscaredpod@gmail.com. And check out the website at talkingscaredpod.com. The Patreon's there if you want more from me, including what is now part one of a mammoth AMA session that I collected questions for, some pretty meaty things I've been asked to address, so for that peek behind the curtain and tons of other stuff, just go to patreon.com/talkingscaredpod. Next week, we're going deep into creepy country, aka the Hudson River Valley, with Sam Rebeline and his debut, Edenville. It's a joyously mad book. It's kind of like John Langan on really good acid. Until then, try anything once, celebrate your mistakes, and cling to the fun in this hard, hard world. Read good books, and remember, it's good to be scared.